Well, in terms of like what your father did, he brought you into his pharmacy and showed you how to measure stuff. Do you or your wife ever bring your daughter into the lab and let her play around?
Well,
I wouldn't say play around since you haven't used either radioactive isotopes in here, right. But you know.
Yes, in fact, well, you know what? Because we still talk science at home a lot. She knows some of the terms that we use. she comes to my lab whenever she has something in the school that she got off. I bring her, or she, you know, oftentimes these days what happens, she stays in my lab in the morning to my wife's lab and in the afternoon in my lab. So yeah, she comes around.
Well, given that she's been raised with, you know, people talking shop at the dinner table, does she contribute to your scientific ideas as well now?
No, that has not happened, but she would ask, when she knows that I'm submitting a paper, she asks, whatever would happen, I'd kind of look, the paper is something you got accepted. She goes, oh, let's go celebrate, you know, things like that. So you know, she's 9 years old, she's still a child, and
do you sit down and do mathematical puzzles with her?
I have not done that, but I have. What I have started to do is, well, her mother used to do homework with her, take care of that part. But since this year, I have started doing it. I'm hoping that I would slowly take her. I do not want to do like way my grandfather did,
to me. Okay.
Because I don't think you know, back then in India, you play games with your friends at home. There is nothing else to do. There's no TV. The radio is very well controlled. There's only one or two stations that you can play to. Only one or few interesting programs you can listen to. So at home, there's not too much you can do. So if you're stuck with a mathematical puzzle, well, that's one way to continue doing. But here at home, you know, she has so many attractions in it. So,
Okay, let me pause the tape a minute. Okay, to move around a bit, I wanted to ask about, you know, when you originally have come to the United States, you had mentioned that you thought you'd get a PhD and then go back to India and work at some research institute. And I wanted to ask, what happened to that idea? Why did you choose to do a postdoc in the United States, and why haven't you chosen to return to India, and is that still a possibility?
You know, the opportunity to go do science made the difference. In fact, if I go to India, I won't be able to do science at the level I'm doing now. And so that will be a totally different life. And I will have to take simply a teaching job. You know, I have thought of that seriously many, many times. And I realized that I won't be able to do any good science if I go back into India. because there's simply not enough money, not enough opportunity to do science. So as long as I want to do science, this is the heaven, basically. I miss my family, and then, if I lose all my grants, I will go back. and then, if I'm unable to do science, I probably will go back to India, because there are other interesting things that I'll probably be able to enjoy if I cannot do science.
Such as?
Oh, the culture is so rich. I probably will enjoy it over there than here. Although my growing daughter might have a say at that point, and so those are difficult things to talk about.
Well, if you had to list one or two things that you miss most about India in terms of its kind of rich culture, what would pop to your mind?
Well, I used to go to plays, mm-hmm. you know, a lot. Those plays are, if you compare to plays in this country, they're very comparable in terms of quality.
Mm-hmm.
But then they are dealing with the tradition, culture of that country where I was born and I grew up for 23 years before coming here. So I still, for example, last night, you know, this festival or function, program I went to, I enjoyed it enormously. So those are the kinds of things that I would be able to do more if I...
Yeah.
Plus, you know, my family, everybody is there, and my sisters, my brother, and especially my brother. I'm so fond of him. He's very funny. He's humorous, and he just sit there and make you laugh, and it's so entertaining just to spend time with him. So I'll have a lot more to, if I cannot do science, then I'll have a lot more to do in India than I have here. Because if I do not do science, the only thing I'll be doing is teaching, and that's all. I can do that in India too.
Okay. Well, you had mentioned several minutes ago that... you know, that your friend, the Howard Hughes investigator, you spend equal amounts of energy, and he publishes in Cell, and you publish in MCB, and that, you know, it is important where you publish, because they're both good, but the audience is different. They're both good journals, but the audience is different. And you have to advertise your science, is what you said. And why does one have to advertise their science?
Well, you know, that is... Well, this is an unfortunate thing. There's not a good answer for it. Thing is, if you want to get funds, you have to be a known person. Often in review sessions, they look at, you know, where you publish, and then they look at whether they know you. So it is important in terms of getting funds. It is important in terms of drawing attraction to what you're doing. Basically everything that are related to advertisement. Often I have seen that paper I published in Cell drawn so much attention that people have gotten into it and done good work. That is a big help in the scientific community. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened to works that have published in other journals. So more these journals like Cell, because many people read it, there's a very good chance someone will like it and do something which adds to my work, or takes it to a totally different direction from what I've done. So it is important to advertise your science.
Okay. Well, do you think that being here at this institution, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute found itself with too much money this year and appointed a 20 or 22 extra investigators this year in order to meet their tax bracket needs? Do you think that the Howard Hughes Medical Institute would appoint you, being at this institution, would appoint you an investigatorship here, or even a colleague in your department?
I do not know the deal there, and I would like to find out about it, how they go about it. Unfortunately, I do not know the deal. Obviously, university has to make some kind of effort to get Howard Hughes show interest in one of the faculty members, and that's how I think it works. And I frankly speaking, I do not have the information.
Right. Yeah. Okay. But if they did give you the nod, you'd take it.
Oh yeah.
Okay. And I wanted to go back to the issue of the ability you've had here to attract good graduate students and good postdocs, because we've been interviewing on Saturday and Sunday, and your lab has certainly been quiet. But I, even walking down the hallways, there's other labs that are even more quiet than
right.
yours right now.
Right.
And what difference does it make in terms of your ability to attract good graduate students, good students, versus your ability to attract students, just to have students in here? You had mentioned that right now you don't have that many because you just graduated
right,
several.
Right. Well, you know, I have taken students who are average, and they have other interests in life. Doing PhD is a means of earning salary.
Mm-hmm.
And I had problems with that kind of person. And I did not consider them as good student. And obviously, you know, they are not going to go very far. Unless they change their ideas altogether. What I tried to do is tell them that there's a purpose here, and you know, the purpose is probably more important than any average thing you do on a routine basis at home. But it simply doesn't work to... I get the feeling that there's some students, they just have it, some people just have it. It is just so easy to tell them and they know what you're talking. And there's some students, you simply cannot communicate and tell them that if you have an urge to do something in life, how can you stay away from the lab? I do not understand this. That is the unfortunate scenario in this university. That's what you saw in this floor. There's so many labs you walked by. And there's not a single human being working in this lab. I never saw it in other universities I was. And I come here every day. I come here Saturdays, Sundays, try to do things. Because if you... You see the problem that if these people who work here, they don't have the urge to get something done, to do. And unfortunately, I have not found that kind of people here. Whereas in other places, thing is, it has to do with the environment. If there are 6 people in the lab, if 3 of them are coming in the weekend trying to do things, then that probably motivates other people. In this kind of place, it is very hard to get even 3 people to do. The university was never attractive or never known to be a good research institute. They are obviously trying now. The administration is now trying to build it, but it will take some time. They are trying to, their hope is if they could recruit good faculty members, aggressive researchers, then this place might become. But we, who are being recruited by these people, we have the trouble of recruiting associates who are good. I cannot imagine a good American student will come to this university. There's no reason for a good American student to come to this university, because it's U of C. It's not Western. They are better known place for their research. Mm. Although in terms of doing science, my lab does as good science as someone in U of C, not Western. I get invited to give presentation, and I know that my science is as good as them, but unfortunately, the university is not attractive. So there is a deficiency here.
Well, in the ideal situation, how big would you want your lab to be?
Well, I have been to big labs. And big labs, they run, although they have like 20, 25 people in the lab, at any given time, there are only 5 people who are really good and productive. If I have 2 good people in the lab, I can do a lot. And at some point in my lab, there was like about 10 people. And then there was a time my lab had like 4 people, like right now maybe. I am as productive, if not more, or producing more, better quality work. So I do not think I want to grow very big. But I would like to be very selective and get good people to work with them, because I ended up spending a lot of time trying to train them. It is a lot of time I spend trying to train them. And I want to see if that goes somewhere. I spent that was the feeling I got with one of my students, that I spent quite a bit of time in 4 years talking to him every day. And then when this person gets a PhD, and if his life is totally driven by something else, unrelated to science, then where did your effort go?
Well, and what about getting good technicians? How is your ability to get good technicians, and is the university, it seems to me this would be a fairly competitive market in Chicago, given all the institutions.
Right, right. Yeah, that's something I have started thinking, that instead of recruiting, I would probably start recruiting technicians. There are, often there are postdocs whose wife looking for a technician position. They are able person. Often we end up in a situation like this. I have not recruited anybody as a technician, full-time technician in my lab. I have always had part-time technicians in my lab. I was the initial 4 or 5 years, I was against having technician in my lab as a full-time worker, because in my postdoctoral life I had difficulties dealing with technicians, because often I found that the ones that I dealt with, they do not think, and they just do what they are told to do. So on the other hand, I found that the postdocs, they think, and then they try to do things by themselves. So I was more interested to recruit postdocs and technicians. But then that idea is probably going to change a little bit. I found that often some postdocs, they are very disruptive in their thinking, and then they are doing things in the lab. One postdoc I had to ask him to leave after 2 years. He was not. He worked hard, sincere, but he had his ideas and then set up ideas about going things which is not right, which is not logical. On the other hand, a technician would have listened to me more, and then I would have been more productive with a technician. So yeah, something I'm thinking about. But I have not done it yet.
Okay, well, you've worked within a variety of scientific settings, and you had mentioned at Albert Einstein that it was very much, you thought, like the German system where the chair is the big person and then the assistant professors are underneath him. And it's changed now, but Rockefeller was clearly of the empire kind of structure of American science. And you worked in medical colleges at the Rockefeller, which doesn't even have an undergraduate population, it's just graduates, only graduate and postdocs, and at Duke, which I don't know at the time, but Nevins now is a Howard Hughes medical investigator, so you worked under that umbrella. And you worked here, which is, you have said that it has been traditionally known as a teaching institution, emphasis on teaching rather than bench science. And how do you see the way that we, and you just mentioned that perhaps, you know, how technicians versus postdocs is an important issue of, you know, there are certain advantages to having postdocs, but there are certain advantages of having technicians. how we structure our science across the various institutions. One, to maximize intellectual resources, and two, to maximize financial resources. Because if a good scientist happens to be stuck at an institution like this, and another scientist happens to be at an institution as a Howard Hughes medical investigator, it could change the complete nature of, you know, the kind of science that they do. So how can you see a way of structuring our science to maximize all these different resources?
Well, you are asking a difficult question.
Well,
you're right. Structuring science. The ideal situation is obviously, you know, is. I mean, if you ask me, I would like to be in Howard Hughes Institute. And do the best science that I can. Invent, discover new things. That's what I like to do aggressively in an environment where my associates are intelligent, dedicated scientists. And in a place like this, it becomes more of trying to convert non-believers. I do not know how, you know, productive these things are in terms of, you know, training people. So that is this place has to develop. This kind of university, this kind of place, they have to develop to become more attractive, so that they can afford to be little selective in terms of who they recruit as students, who they recruit as postdocs. Other big universities, many students who are recruited here, they won't be recruited there. Like people like me who are stuck here, what they shouldn't do science? Well, then the two way of thinking. My way of thinking, well, no, they should do science, but this university should develop such that they should try to help this kind of people in whatever way they can, so that they can do science in a more competitive way, rather than cutting down this kind of university from doing science. That's not going to be a fair thing, because I still think that these universities, there are some good scientists who did, you know, there are other Pew scholars in these universities, so they do good science. And then, so if this university at some point earned the fame of U of C, for example, if this university becomes aggressive, build new buildings, attract good scientists from outside, a senior scientist from outside, come in here and run their labs, then this will become an attractive place. So it has to do with the university more, how they want to develop science in the university. So the university administration has to be, you know, more. They have to change a little bit. Like many universities, they have changed. They spend a lot of money. They build building, they offered a lot of things to two or three senior, well-known scientists. And they have moved in. As a result, they're there. They become center of attraction for other scientists to come into this place. I think that's how these type of universities has to develop. And then it is unfortunate that I am here for 7 years. I have not seen that these the administrators here are going after this, you know, these kind of things more aggressively. They tried, but they are not. They have not done it successfully. So, I do not know whether I answered your question.
Well, do you see in your future a move into administration or more administrative type responsibilities that would be more in a position to make some of these changes?
Well, not in recent future, because even now I think I'm more on the bench. I like to, because once you move into administration, it becomes a different ball game. But I, if I decide that this is the university I'm going to spend my whole life, yes, at some point I would like to get into this and make sure that I try to bring in good people in this university. I am actively involved in search committees. I serve in multiple search committees, often outside the department, just so that I can help identify good scientists and come in here. And I would like to, at some, you know, if, as I said, if I decide to stay here, I would definitely like to take a part and improve the situation, because many administrators here, they are here for a long time and they are comfortable with things here. People who are comfortable with the situation, they're not going to change anything. It's only the people who are not comfortable.
Okay, and let me ask something completely different, or maybe not completely different, but how do you define good science, and how would you define a good scientist?
A good science is that you pursue one thing and build a story, make an observation, and then build a story, build basically from one observation you go on building stories, pursue one thing. Even how, you know, however small it is, pursue it and take it to a bigger thing, and things that people know but didn't think that way. I think that's good science. Obviously, the person who's doing it is a good scientist.
Yeah.
So I think the person who develops a new idea and then pursues it, and then often I have seen people publish one paper and then move on, does not pursue that, then that becomes a loss. Then it happened to me also. I like to, you know, develop things from one thing to, you know, it's like growing a tree, basically. It must be linked. logically linked to one thing. Many most good scientists are like this. That's how they do science.
Okay. Well, I think two more questions, and I'll be and I'll turn it over to you. You developed a new assay. It was in your PNAS paper to overcome a particular problem of assay for phosphorylation, I believe. And but you also in a Cell paper proposed a novel mechanism to explain transcription.
Right, right.
And where do you see your abilities lying? Is it in developing new technologies in order to overcome technical problems, or do you see yourself more as a proposer of new theories of thinking about things and proposing new ideas?
Yeah, it is very clear to me that I am not good at developing new techniques. I spend very little time. In fact, I like to see other people developing
okay.
techniques and use them to prove my ideas.
Okay.
So I mainly try to pursue something, story, but not techniques. I know it is very important, but I don't have a knack for it. I have seen people doing it. They spend a lot of time trying to develop a technique. And I know that that is very important because that will have a lot of application and use. I spend very little time on that kind of thing. I rather spend time trying to prove my ideas using those techniques. So I spend lot less time.
And where do the true revolutions come from then? Is it breaking technology barriers or breaking theoretical barriers?
It's both. It has the technological barriers. Those are so important. Without that, you know, I can have as many ideas as I can. It's no use.
Okay. Well, last question is, how has the Pew Scholars Program influenced both your intellectual development as a scientist and your professional development as a scientist?
Well, it has helped me many ways. First of all, the money was given to me at a time when I really needed it. So I could recruit people and try to do what I was trying to do. In fact, something that I think I've developed now is because of Pew money that I've gotten 4, 5, 6 years ago. It took me a bit longer, but I did develop it, and I think that what I've developed is much more important than what I proposed. So, you know, because of the Pew money, I could do that. The other thing that happened is the conferences, the meetings that I went to, I saw many, many good scientists doing totally different kinds of things at one place, which I am not used to seeing before that, because I used to go to meetings that are related to my work. But here is a meeting where I saw neurobiologists, I saw people who are doing totally different kinds of things, but they're doing outstanding science. So it actually, it's that part also played, I think, a big role in trying to change my thinking or develop my thinking or to my maturity. So I think I consider myself blessed with this Pew Foundation because I was able to see these people because of Pew Scholarship. And of course the funding helped me a lot.
So do you plan attending the next alumni meeting?
Oh yes.
Okay.
So you don't want to be, so yes.
Okay, well, that's it for the questions I have, and at this point I would like to turn it over to you and ask you if there's anything that you would like to talk about, any questions that you would like, topics you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered.
I think we covered almost everything. No, I think I've talked too much.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time out to do this.
Sure, sure.
Thanks a lot.